What is your morning routine? Is there a particular liquid that you have to consume to get the day started? For many people around the world, the answer is yes, and the liquid is coffee. Coffee has been a big deal for humans for a long time and figures to continue in that capacity for a long time to come. Mark Pendergrast gives us a comprehensive look at the relationship in the book Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. Mark Pendergrast is a writer and scholar with many interests. He says he also brews a fantastic cup of coffee. The first edition of Uncommon Grounds came out in 1999, and Mark has traveled far and wide in search of coffee and stories since. Mark, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm surprised you didn't write a whole new book. I mean, how much more have you learned about coffee over the last 20 years?
Well, I've traveled, as you said, quite a bit, and, you know, it's funny. What I wrote back 20 years ago has sort of stood the test of time in terms of the major themes that were set out. The boom-bust cycle where the price of coffee goes up and then down in somewhat predictable cycles continues, even though some people think it's not going to. The absolute obsession with getting the best cup of coffee and how to brew it continues. There are more and more contests and blogs and apps and podcasts about coffee. Those are new since, you know, the internet took over the world. And the internet itself has created much more knowledge among people who really didn't understand why the price of their coffee was fluctuating so wildly. The coffee industry has consolidated even more. But at the same time, there are more and more micro roasters springing up all the time who are trying to get the freshest beans to you as possible and who are obsessed with, you know, finding not only the best country, not only the best plantation, but perhaps the best place on that plantation. And they're getting involved with how to process the coffee in various ways. So it's become even a more fascinating and complicated topic.
Let's come to one of the ones you broached a couple times already, the boom and bust cycle, because you pointed out that this happened through history, and at some point I think people might have thought they would get away from this, but it keeps happening. What are the dynamics there?
Well, this all began to occur in the late 19th century, when coffee became an industrial product, which is a problem because it was basically stale by the time it got to most people, because once you roast coffee, it begins to stale immediately if you allow it in contact with oxygen. At any rate, what happened was Brazil began to produce a huge amount of coffee by the late 19th century, and they were taking over from the East Indies, where Java and Yemen and Ethiopia had dominated the industry, but they began to suffer from a coffee rust called Himalaya vastastrix. At any rate, more and more coffee was being grown. There were attempts by brokers in New York to corner the market to make sure that the price kept going up. But eventually, with too much coffee, that attempt was broken. The prices tumbled dramatically. And what happens then is that growers began to grow. You know, they didn't prune their trees. They sometimes would cut them down out of desperation. They wouldn't harvest in a timely manner. They couldn't afford to because the price had gone below the cost of production. And so gradually the oversupply would dwindle. And by the way, they also established a futures market for coffee, which has led to speculation that also drives the cost up and down, independently of whether it's really a supply and demand issue.
So it's been on a commodity as a commodity, like gold or oil.
Yes, there is a coffee futures market that's quite active. At any rate, after a few years, the price would begin to go up again. People would begin to plant more coffee and hope that, you know, they could take advantage of that. Because it takes 3 or 4 years for coffee to mature, then it would take a while for an oversupply situation to happen again. And then the price would tumble again. This is all complicated by a frost or a or a drought in Brazil, which can suddenly affect the market, or could suddenly affect the market. And then in recent years, Vietnam became a major producer of cheaper coffee. That drove the price down and created a coffee crisis in 2001. And now some people are thinking that because of climate change affecting the production of coffee, where the better coffee is having to climb higher up mountainsides to simplify matters, there's going to be a shortage of good coffee, and therefore, with the increased consumption of coffee, with Asia, China, and Korea, and the Japanese have always been consumers since World War II, that we will not have this bus cycle anymore, but guess what? We still do.
So much more to learn about from Mark Pendergrast. His book is Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. We'll come back and talk more with Mark. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Let's do the history lesson at this point, Mark, and the legend of coffee's discovery in the story. Who was Caldy, and what did he see his goats doing?
Caldy was an Ethiopian goat herd, a young boy who would call his goats every day, and one day they didn't come back. So he went to look for them, and high on a mountainside, they were frisking about and butting each other and obviously enjoying themselves. And he noticed that they were eating the leaves and the berries of a shrub, a sort of tree that grew to maybe 15, 20 feet high under the rainforest canopy. So he decided he would sample them himself. He discovered that the berries had a very hard inner core, but that the cherry itself was fairly sweet. And he began to feel good, too. So he began to frisk around with his goats, and that supposedly is how coffee was first discovered. I doubt that that's really the case, although there really are goats that wander around in Ethiopia to this day. At any rate, somebody probably as long ago as 800 AD discovered that this plant contained some kind of drug that could keep you awake, that made you think more clearly. The imams of the time began to use it to stay awake for midnight prayers, but they didn't actually brew coffee the way we know it, probably until sometime in the 1400s. They apparently ground the hard cherries, the seeds of them, and mix them with animal fat for a quick energy boost. They made a tea out of the leaves, which also contained caffeine. They made a drink called kisher out of the pulp that was dried. But nobody thought to really roast the seeds until sometime in the probably late 1400s, and that is lost in history. But my guess is that somebody was boiling water and accidentally spit some of the seeds out into the fire, and it smelled good. And somehow or other, somebody got the idea of throwing it into the water, and it smelled even better, and so coffee of some sort was formed. The Ethiopians since then developed a very elaborate and wonderful coffee ceremony where they roast the beans over sort of a giant wok over a fire and grind them right away, totally fresh, often putting in cinnamon or cardamom, and now often sugar. And they will serve it very ceremoniously in three successive servings of the drink.
Does the ceremony still exist?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow. So have you've attended it sounds like.
I have. You can attend it in the United States, probably, if you search around for a good Ethiopian restaurant. And they'll probably serve it to you along with popcorn.
So as coffee began to spread from its roots in Ethiopia, North Africa, the Middle East, and found new cultures, did it always become significant in the new cultures? I mean, has any culture ever been sort of meh about coffee?
No, they all use coffee in one way or another. The Turks continue to boil it, which I don't think is a very good way to do it. But they, you know, everybody sort of gets used to whatever coffee they like. The Europeans began to filter it and add milk to it, particularly Northern Europeans. Southern Europeans, not so much, partly because many of them are lactose intolerant. But in the American West, it was boiled, and you'd put dried fish skin or egg shells in it to clarify it. In other words, to get the coffee grounds to sink to the bottom so that you could drink it. And then eventually we began to percolate coffee, not a very good way to make it either. Nowadays, they're very, you know, fine pour-over methods of doing it just exactly right. You can also infuse it in a French press, which is also a great way to make coffee, but kind of messy. There's the AeroPress now, and of course espresso machines were invented in the 20th century in Italy. So there are numerous ways to enjoy coffee. And also nowadays there's cold brew, often made with the same method as Guinness, with liquid nitrogen that creates a foam that makes it sort of naturally sweeter tasting.
I was just hearing about that this week. Mark Pendergrast is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. So what is your preferred method? You talked about some that are better and worse. What's your preferred method of making a cup of coffee?
I prefer the pour-over method. But I also like the French press. I am not that keen on espresso, so I usually, if I want espresso or an espresso drink, I go to a good local coffee house.
Let's take a call in here. John in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Pendergrast, the author of Uncommon Grounds.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's Dale. Because I know that, like with bread, I know what a stale piece of bread's like. So how would I know? And second is, are the coffee companies like MJB and Folgers, you know, back in the 60s when they didn't have gourmet coffees, are they still around?
So how to know when coffee is stale and are the old companies around? Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it.
Okay. Well, if you get a decent coffee that is 100% Arabica, you'll probably see what looks like a little belly button in it. And if you squish it, the air will go in. I mean, it will come out, but it won't come in. And so that's a good indication that it might not be totally fresh, but this one-way valve bag allows the degassing of coffee, where it lets out the carbon dioxide that's produced during the roasting. But it doesn't let oxygen in, and that has really revolutionized the way coffee is packaged and made it a little bit, it can last for several months that way and still be relatively fresh. If you get a can of coffee, unless it's Ely Cafe, which has a method of pressurizing the coffee so that it does stay fresh. Most canned coffee is going to be pre-stale to some degree. If you buy whole beans that are loose, you know, at a local roaster, you should ask them how long they've been there. If they've been there more than a few days, it's likely that they're going to be stale. In answer to your question, MJB, I don't know if it still exists or not. Folgers certainly does still exist in a big way. It's part of a conglomerate now, but it, you know, and the story of Folgers and all of those early beans, I think, is fascinating. Folgers was founded by Jim Folger when he was 14 years old. He and his older brothers went from Nantucket, where they were a whaling family, and the whales were beginning to be fished out, to the California Gold Rush of 1849, and Folger began to roast coffee for the miners, and that's how Folger's got its start.
I was just looking up, there is still an MJB coffee with the full story of Max J. Brandenstein and all the details there on the website. I want to come much further back in time, though, to talk about the plants that give us coffee. They're native to which continents?
Well, they're all native to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Coffee, Arabica coffee, is native to Ethiopia. Robusta, which is another commercial type of coffee, also called Cannephora, it probably originated in Ghana, we're not sure, but somewhere in West Africa. And it grows lower down, can withstand greater heat. It has a larger amount of caffeine, about twice as much caffeine, but it doesn't taste as good. It has more of a bitter, woody taste to it, to most of them. There are now people who are trying to produce, you know, specialty Robusta that is more carefully processed, et cetera. But by and large, Arabica is superior to Robusta. And there are a number of other varieties of coffee, but none of them have made it commercially. But they're native to Africa. Then coffee spread around the world so that first, you know, at first the Arabs had a monopoly on it. It was being grown in Yemen across the Red Sea, where it had been exported. But they were parboiling the beans so that nobody else could grow any until an Indian pilgrim named Baba Budan smuggled some fertile seeds out in his belt sometime in the early 1600s and began to grow it in India. The Dutch got hold of some fertile beans and began to grow them in their greenhouses, and then they began to grow coffee in Java and Ceylon and Sulawesi and et cetera. And then the French got hold of a coffee seedling from the Dutch, and they brought it over to Haiti and Martinique. And from that one seedling, supposedly most of the coffee in Latin America descended. And in all of these places, you had human rights issues. Slaves were imported from Africa. There had already been imported to grow sugar. And so the first successful slave revolt occurred in San Domingo, where Haiti is now, in 1791. And at that point, that one island produced about half of the world's coffee.
Wow.
And the destruction of the coffee and sugar industries put Haiti onto a downward poverty-stricken path for a long time, but it was certainly understandable that they wanted to revolt. The Indians in Central America were by and large forced into labor that was equivalent to slavery and debt peonage, where they would loan them money that they never could pay back, and so they had to keep working on the coffee plantations. The Dutch enslaved the natives in the East Indies, and so coffee has had you know, a terrible history in terms of human rights abuses. And the fact is that most people who work on larger coffee farms make an average of about $3 a day, and often, you know, have poor nutrition, et cetera. So this has been an issue that recurs over and over and over again. And although there are many attempts to make sure that coffee workers are treated fairly through certifications such as Fair Trade or a new one called In Veritas, it continues to be a huge problem, and there are problems with fair trade as well. So it's a complicated issue. You have to read the book.
Mark Pendergrast is the author of Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. We are open to phone calls and emails from you with your questions, comments, concerns about coffee. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So obviously, labor abuses, land abuses as well, as you point out, a huge environmental cost in Brazil, you point out. Is there a country that at some point began getting things about right in labor and land use? Are we still seeking that that elusive balance, Mark?
We're still seeking that elusive balance, but nowadays there's been a real emphasis on shade-grown coffee instead of, in other words, for a long time there was technified coffee that would grow in the full sunshine. And as you said, in Brazil they simply clear-cut the rainforest, burned it down, grew coffee and the fertile ashes until the land was played out, and then they would move on to somewhere else. In places like Costa Rica, they have been much more aware of the environmental consequences. I attended the first recognition at the National Zoo at the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center back about 22 years ago, because they had figured out that the migratory birds, which were in decline, were going down to Central America and having less and less habitat because they were cutting down the rainforests, but that the coffee that was being grown under a traditional rainforest canopy not only tasted better, but was good for the migratory bird population. So there's been a tremendous effort now, and there are certifications, bird-friendly certifications for that as well, to try to have coffee grown in a more ecologically beneficial way, and also to try to conserve water and not wash the organic matter from coffee downstream where it pollutes the stream, kills the fish, et cetera, and to reuse the pulp, often putting red worms into it to turn it into a good fertilizer, which can then be spread back on the coffee tree. So there are all kinds of innovative processes that are happening now.
You mentioned
and
a vast...
also attempts, I'm sorry, attempts to get the stoves that people use in rural areas not to pollute the air so much.
Oh, and yes, the rocket stoves, coffee. Things like that. You mentioned Vastatrix earlier, Mark, and the rust that forms on some coffee leaves. And it sounds like the approach to growing coffee as a monoculture made pretty easy pickings for it.
It did. You know, coffee is, caffeine is a natural pesticide. And the reason that it grows in tropical plants of various kinds, but mostly in coffee, is that it's a pesticide that keeps off the predators. And, you know, the predators can be there year-round because there is no winter. And that's why so many psychotropical things such as, you know, cocaine and opium grow in tropical regions because they're trying to be pesticides. But, as you know, whenever you grow a monoculture, something is going to figure out how to get through that. And this fungus did that in the late 1800s and pretty much killed the coffee industry there for many years. It's now come back, and some of the really good coffee that's grown in Sulawesi and Java and places like that, but it's still not nearly as prevalent as the Robusta or tea. Everybody was concerned that this rust would spread to the Western Hemisphere, and eventually it did. So you had a terrible coffee leaf rust epidemic beginning in 2012 or so.
Okay, hold the thought there, Mark. We have to come back. Uncommon Grounds is the book. Back with Mark Pendergrast, our guest, in a minute here on the Jefferson Exchange. So we're talking about Vastatrix, the rust that grows on coffee leaves, and a concern about it getting to the Western Hemisphere, which it did, you say, and not very long ago.
Here a couple of decades ago, but it really, really made an impact just about, you know, not even 10 years ago. So it continues to be a huge problem in Central and South America, where, you know, much of our coffee is grown. So they are trying to develop, you know, they had developed some strains that would resist the leaf rust and survive it. But at that point, they were not concentrating on how the coffee tasted. So now there's a huge rush to try to find, you know, really good-tasting Arabica coffee that will resist the rust. At the same time, they're being hit with climate change, which may have been one of the reasons behind the leaf rust. So it's a huge problem and will continue to be so for quite some time, I'm afraid.
So, Mark, let's talk about American consumption of coffee. When did it take off? When it really get adopted and embraced in America?
Well, in 1773, there was a Boston Tea Party, and although that didn't immediately cause huge coffee consumption in the United States, it really did make people like John Adams write to his wife and say, I'm going to have to learn to love coffee now because it's unpatriotic to drink tea anymore. But it really took off after the Civil War. During the Civil War, the Union had a trade embargo imposed on the South, so they couldn't get hold of coffee, and they ate, you know, all kinds of substitutes, such as roasted acorns. The Union soldiers could get coffee and totally appreciated it, so that after the war, when you began to have the Industrial Revolution big way, someone invented a really good coffee roaster, an automatic one, and you began to have concerns such as Chase and Sanborn, Hills Brothers, Folgers, Maxwell House coffee developed during that time. And coffee consumption in the U.S. Took off. So it continued to grow right up through World War II, when, again, they developed instant coffee just before World War II, a really good instant coffee. I mean, supposedly better than what they had during
World War I. I was about to say, instant coffee, good instant coffee is a contradiction in terms, I think, for some people.
It was better than what they'd had during World War I is what I meant. It was a problem because after World War II, they began to make instant coffee much more popular during the, you know, everybody wanted instant TV dinners and instant everything. And because of that and because of price wars among the coffee roasters, they began to cheapen the blends by adding more and more Robusta to them. And consumption actually went down. But nobody recognized it because people were brewing more diluted coffee because it tasted so awful. So they were drinking more cups but getting less coffee. Finally, the coffee industry realized that their lunch was being eaten by Coca-Cola and Pepsi as in terms of caffeine delivery, and they didn't quite know what to do about it. So the specialty coffee revolution began in the 60s and 70s where Starbucks and many Pete's began it, and Starbucks came along a few years later, and many other small roasters around the country were rediscovering the joys of fresh roasted coffee delivered locally, a discovery that's still being made all around the country.
So a couple of names I want to
bring. So our consumption has gone up marginally, mm-hmm. but not as much as you'd think.
Okay, that is interesting to know. I would have thought it would have zoomed at some point. Some of the additives that you list in the book, I mean, I've heard of chicory in coffee before, but a lot of other things you point out had been used as well.
Yeah, chicory is the most important one because of the French. Under Napoleon, he decided that they should only drink what they could import. What they could grow themselves, not import. And so they could grow chicory. And as a result, the French developed a taste for it, and when they could get coffee again, they began to mix it in with their coffee. And that's why in New Orleans, with the French influence there, you get chicory mixed with the coffee. But yeah, anything from dandelion to acorns to barley to all kinds of adulterants were routinely added to coffee before the Food and Drug Act was passed in 1906.
So this brings in the name C.W. Post, who was known for cereals and a university on Long Island. What did he bring to the coffee table?
C.W. Post had a nervous breakdown and went to the sanatorium run by Harvey Kellogg in Battle Creek, Michigan. And he was inspired by the fact that Harvey Wiley didn't like coffee, and he also produced these cereals. So he had a cereal coffee, and C.W. Post imitated it and called it Postum. And he produced some very effective ads saying that coffee was terrible for you. There were pseudoscientific ads that basically said that coffee nerves were ruining people's lives and that the only way to get around that was to drink lots of Postum. He also invented grape nuts, by the way. Postum, I don't even know if they make it anymore, but at the time it was a hugely profitable venture, and it drove the coffee men absolutely out of their mind. It was just one of the times in our country that people have thought, not just in our country but in others, that coffee was the worst thing in the world for you. The women of England thought that it made their men impotent and had a petition against it back in the 1670s. So back in around 1980, there were all kinds of epidemiological studies that indicated that coffee caused pancreatic cancer or breast lumps or that it caused heart attacks, et cetera. And none of those have withstood the test of time. Much better epidemiological studies now indicate that coffee doesn't cause any of those problems. And as a matter of fact, it helps prevent suicides. It helps prevent liver cancer. It helps prevent type 2 diabetes. So it's gotten a much cleaner bill of health in recent years, although I still suggest that pregnant women cut down or avoid it altogether because caffeine is an addictive drug, mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want my child born addicted.
Well, good point. We were talking about coffee consumption in the United States, that it hasn't mushroomed quite the way you might have thought. But I have to wonder, over its history in the United States, was coffee ever seriously threatened for long by another drink?
Yes. As I mentioned, Coca-Cola and Pepsi right. were beginning to steal an entire generation, my generation, the Pepsi generation. And at that point, consumption was declining substantially. But then, of course, Coca-Cola and Pepsi have been suffering their own terrible fates in the last 10 or 20 years because of the obesity epidemic that they have contributed the sugary soft drinks to. So their consumption is going down at the same time that coffee is becoming cooler and better. And there's really no evidence that coffee does anything terrible to children, by the way. although I think that once you get this idea that something is terrible for you, it lasts in a culture a long time.
Yeah, indeed.
But no, coffee is not. Tea has certainly always been a big competitor to coffee. And tea is sort of got a gentler caffeine delivery system and has antioxidant health benefits even more than coffee does. So you're beginning to see some inroads from tea, but it's not as sexy as coffee.
No, it certainly isn't. Ken in Ashland emails, I have a friend in Bali who manufactures a home roasting machine for making, in quotes, the freshest brew at home with, in quotes, just roasted beans. What do you think of the process? Is it worth the extra hassle? That from Ken in Ashland.
There are many ways that you can roast your own coffee. Perhaps the cheapest way is with a fluid air process using a popcorn popper. Huh. It works pretty well. Takes about 15 minutes that way. But you can buy some very elegant home roasters, either drum or fluid air, that throw the beans around in hot air. Just look online, and you don't have to go quite as far away as Bali to get them. I'm sure the one in Bali is good.
Is the quality of the coffee as good, I think, is what Ken is asking. I mean, is it worth it to do the roasting yourself in addition to the grinding?
I think it's worth it because it's, you know, absolutely fresh. If you are really, really a coffee nut, you should at least, you know, try it. Because, you know, when you... If you grind it up immediately, it actually foams almost like a soft drink because it's produced all this carbon dioxide. So it's kind of an exciting process.
Wow, that does sound fun.
So it tastes really fresh, obviously. It is really fresh.
So in your coffee explorations, I was wondering pretty much from page one whether you'd ever had Kopi Luwak. Is it as good as the legends say?
I don't like Kopi Luwak very much. This is the coffee that is produced through the gut of the civet cat. And it's considered a delicacy in Indonesia and in other parts of the world. And it's relatively rare because the civet cats usually eat it at night and then they poop it. And so they poop out the seeds that have been stripped of the outer pulp and everything. So it's kind of a natural wet process for coffee. I described it as having a certain gutsy quality. it does add a different taste to it. I wouldn't pay all that huge amount of money for it. It's also become quite controversial because it was so expensive. Some people have kept civet cats in cages and force-fed them coffee so that it's, you know, an animal rights issue, justifiably. And you have to be careful. If you do buy Kopi Luwak, make sure that it's from wild civet cats and not in captivity. I wrote a book called Beyond Fair Trade about Doi Chang coffee, and I actually witnessed where they got their coffee from up on the mountainsides, and it is natural. So you can rest assured if you get it that it's good stuff.
So just about a minute left here, Mark. I mean, do you see anything prying coffee out of our fingers? We certainly seem to love it a bit more over time.
No. I think that coffee is going to continue to evolve. The huge number of competitions that you have now, whether it's the Ely Cafe competition between their own growers that happens once a year in New York City, or whether it's barista competitions or coffee mixed drinks or espresso. You know, there are so many people now. Probably about 100 million people make their living from coffee one way or another, from growing it to exporting and importing to retailing it, roasting it, et cetera. It's not going to go away, no. It's going to continue to have its problems. It's going to continue to have arguments about the best way to brew it and the best way to try to make it more equitable for the people who are doing the essential labor on the farm.
Well, 100 million people, that is a lot. Not all of them on the farm, obviously, but they can all use some tender, loving care. The book is called Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. It's originally published in 1999 with a renewed edition just out by Mark Pendergraft, its author. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. That will do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers are John Baxter and April Ehrlich of JPR News. Our student assistant, Randy Babbitt, is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day.